Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the meeting, town hall meeting regarding Gustavus Sepsig study. We're going to introduce the engineers from HDR who are working on behalf of the city through the Department of Environmental Conservation Village Safe Water to meet the community and collect on the ground information in order to develop alternatives to solving septic needs in Gustavus. And I'm going to hand over the meeting now to City Administrator Kathy Leary to explain further.
Hi, good evening, everyone. So today we we welcomed the two engineers from HDR, Anson and Casey, and they've been going around Gustavus and learning about some of our lands and sites and previous considerations and potential future considerations, and they're trying to get a feel for the various areas that have potential. With myself and John Barry and Mike Taylor are assisting with that, and they will they're working on this preliminary engineering report process, and I'm going to turn it over to them to describe the process, and then if people have comments or suggestions or anything they'd like to interject, just raise your hand in the meeting, and we'll call on you. Thank you.
All right. I guess I'll introduce myself. My name's Anson Moxness. I'm a water wastewater engineer with HDR, and I've been doing either septic or wastewater related work for the past 12 years now. So,
you might move that mic a little closer to you.
Okay, there we go. I guess Casey, go ahead.
Do the thing. Okay, perfect. And my name's Casey Kent. I'm here with Anson. I have been with HDR and working on water wastewater projects for about 3 years now. And Anson and I have done 5 PERs together now in different villages across Alaska. So we're pretty familiar with this process. I'm excited to help Gustavus through it. We've also worked with Anita. Anita, I don't know if your microphone is working, but I think you should also introduce yourself and your role in this project.
Can you hear me? I'm not sure if my microphone is working.
You're good. We got you.
Oh, great. Yes, my name's Anita Erickson. I am the project engineer with the Village Safe Water Program. I manage multiple projects across the state. I've been with the Village Safe Water really only for about 2 years. And prior to that, I have about, time flies, about 30 years of experience with project management. But I'm really looking forward to working with Gustavus further and also with HDR on this. I apologize I won't be able to, that I have not been able to attend this meeting, but hopefully we'll be able to increase the budget and maybe have another trip out there. That is something I'm working on, because these planning projects are somewhat limited in budget. And so this is what we work with, and we do our best to provide the best product as we can, given limited funds.
So I guess first off, I'll go over the process of this PER, the preliminary engineering report, and what it is. It is essentially, at the end, it's a document that goes over a lot of background and history and the current setup, and then a discussion of quite a few different alternatives to address essentially the septage issue in Gustavus. Along with that document, there's a environmental report that is a regulatory type document based on the preferred alternative that comes out of that that PER, the main document there. So the process of what, and I guess the next step is that PER document can be used to acquire funds through various things that Anita can help with. A lot of federal funds require a PER document to then get funding for design and construction and ultimate implementation. So our process now is we're at the very beginning of the process with the site visit and a site visit report. From this, we will kind of go back to our office and take down all of our notes, do a little research, talk with you all afterwards, and come up with a series of alternatives, which will be an alternatives memo that covers each alternative that the then PER will examine. Once we get the green light on those alternatives, we go into the PER phase, which is a much larger document, or like 100 pages of writing, of give or take. There's some maps and pictures in there, so it's not all text. And that will go over much more detailed both cost and scope of the alternatives. Things we'll consider are also ongoing costs of not just the upfront cost of construction, of how much it will cost any alternative to run in the future. And then that will have a 65%, which is sort of the first draft. And that's at that point where we like to get a lot of input from you all. You know, obviously you will be involved in the whole process, but it's kind of the first large deliverable, and get input from the community, make sure that we're on the right track. From there, we do a 95%, which is the almost final draft, which covers our preferred alternative. And then there's a final draft after that. And then the environmental report kind of goes along in there once we come up with a preferred alternative. What else? And then once that's all done, as a community, you can work with Anita to sort of further this project along to get more funds for sort of a final design and construction, however that might look. I guess any questions on the process so far? Yeah.
This is Shelley. I was wondering what the rough timeline is from site visit until you have the...
Oh, I should have brought up my little timeline. But the timeline from the site visit to the alternatives memo is, I want to say, about 3 weeks, something like that. Yeah. And then once that gets reviewed, not only by you all, but the multi-agency review committee, which is a committee of multiple agencies that sort of go over these sort of projects. And they're the ultimate sort of governing committee that reviews each deliverable that we do. They have been taking about a month or so on the short end to review things. But the PER document will then, once we have the final comments from the alternatives, probably about a month after that, we'll start putting together the PER document. And so it's probably, I want to say, I guess, like 6 months. Yeah, 6 months or so, till we're pretty close to the end. And what is required to apply for sort of the next step of funding is actually the 95% draft, not the final draft. Not sure why, but that is the case.
I'd like to kind of interject, if that's okay, yeah. Ensign. I just wanted to perhaps clarify a little bit about the multi-agency review committee. This is a group of people that are comprised of the funders, the people who fund the projects, as well as regulatory
representatives. So throughout the process, they will be, in theory, they will be reading the document and chiming in with their concerns or comments, so that when you get to a point where you have a 95 or 100% complete final planning document, in this case, it's in the form of a preliminary engineering report, there should be no surprises in there for any of the regulators, nor the funding organizations, that they have been involved with throughout the process for this particular project. And when it, so that the thought is so that when it comes time to apply for funding, it should be a fairly smooth process. So you can apply for funding. It's an annual process. And so sometimes the schedule is very tight. And the funders have agreed that if you have a 95% PER by a certain time frame before the deadline, they would be willing to accept that as eligible for funding. Ideally, we'd like to get a 100% final PER along with a resolution from the community, accepting and agreeing that those operation and maintenance costs that may be associated with it is that the community supports the results of the or the recommendations of the preliminary engineering report. So all this is to say that this is not done in a vacuum. And the idea is that we are trying to set up the community for success when it comes to getting funding, and as well as from a regulatory perspective as well, that what is being recommended is acceptable from a regulatory perspective as well. And thank you for letting me interrupt. That's all I had to say, unless you have questions.
By all means, Anita, thank you. This is Shelley again. Is this state and or federal regulatory participants?
It is mostly state, because most of the regulatory programs have been delegated from EPA or other agencies to the state level.
So I understand that a big part of this, after the various recommendations are made or the various scenarios of that we could potentially do in the community, is put out then for public process, similar to tonight. Hopefully we won't have as good weather then the comments and feedback, obviously, from that process would result in choosing and sanctioning via the council an alternative after we know, costs, maintenance costs, all of that, have the community process. And does that fall within that 6-month time frame that you're talking about?
Yeah, that would occur right after the 65%, which is, I want to say probably a few months from now. But that's the period where we've sort of come around to these are the alternatives that are most likely feasible, and then saying, all right, which of these looks best for you guys, and then we will get you that draft report, and then you can, and as Anita said, we actually, part of the PER, the final one, is a resolution from the city council saying we approve of this PER document and its recommended alternatives, preferred alternatives, I think is the language.
So we approve the document with recommended alternatives, but we haven't chosen one yet at that point. We've just been recommended.
Yes.
There may be a few, right? I mean,
yeah. Generally, we generally recommend, from in my experience, is we're recommending one single alternative, or in this case, we might have, okay, what are the alternatives for treating the septage, and then what are the alternatives for disposing of the solids? So our recommended alternative might be one from column A and one from column B to come up with a recommended project, total project.
Okay, thanks.
And I would also say, when we start applying costs and operations and maintenance costs, that seems to do a good job of filtering in one sort of starts to arise as the most feasible and realistic for a community. And I think that becomes really apparent in that 65%. You guys will read through that and be like, yeah, this is what we want. This seems like a thing that we could handle as a community and that we can afford. And then we generally start to move forward with that option as our recommended alternative for that 95%. But that will all make more sense when we get to that point.
Okay, thank you.
So I guess for the next little bit, I'll talk about the actual project rather than the process. So as of right now, and I am obviously not the expert in your septage issues, but because I don't live here, but from our understanding is Juno Septic will come around to the septic tanks, individual septic tanks, with a smaller size pumper truck, pump them out into the newly installed holding facility at the Disposal and Recycling Center, the DRC. And then at some point, the Juno Septic will come with a larger truck to pump those out. And so the real issue here is we're transporting one, a lot of water in that septage. So, and there's a lot of trucking and ferry costs, and the pumping costs are quite high for people. So our goal here is to come up with alternatives that can treat, and or dispose of the septage, ideally within the community. There will likely be disposal alternatives that involve continuing to truck the solids out, whether they're dewatered. Part of this process also involves a no action alternative, is one of the required alternatives that have to be in the report, and that is what you are currently doing now. And so we will kind of look at all of various technologies of how septage is treated and can be treated, and how it can be disposed. And then we'll look at the most practical alternatives there. And then that's kind of that is the topic of that report. So let's see, did I miss anything? I think that's about it. And so I think now, if you guys have any questions from you all, the several people who are online.
This is Mike Taylor. You come back at the 65% level to meet with us, I guess, and answer questions from the public, or
we typically have not. I know Anita is, as she mentioned, the budgets on these projects are fairly small, so there was in the original budget only enough for us to come down this one time, but we're trying to find some more money for that to come down for that 65%. Mm-hmm. If not, we can do a similar thing with Zoom, and mm-hmm. we'll be available to answer questions then. We're hoping that we can come down again, especially if you can guarantee the weather looks like this, but granted, yep. It will probably be October at that point, so guessing not.
Yeah.
But yeah, we're trying to find some funding, but if not, we'll be able to do some sort of Zoom online meeting.
I have one other question. You've laid out the process. Have you had, and you've done this at a number of other communities around the state. What can go wrong with the process? Have you had it fail? And if so, what are the things that we need to be careful about to make sure that we don't fail?
I don't think I've seen any of them fail per se. I think the most important part that I've seen is have the community actively involved. And from what I've seen so far, this is quite, you guys are doing a good job of that. I think that that's the hardest thing for us is if we have to do all of this analysis in a vacuum back in Anchorage. But from what I've seen so far is you guys are very involved. John is a phenomenal resource with a lot of knowledge in this area. So that makes the whole process much smoother. I think that's the biggest part is if it's hard to, if the community is not involved. Okay. So I think
I just want to add to that. The other thing that we've run into is timelines. So as we are, Anson and I work for the state, and the state does the best job they can to turn around these projects, but there are specific timelines that are yearly that occur, and they have a lot of PERs right now across the state. So there's a really high volume going through. I know Anita is working really hard and does a great job of making sure deadlines are met and pushing reviewers to get those back to us so that we can turn around and meet funding deadlines for you. And I think the timing of this project is actually really good because I think that one of those deadlines is in like March or something. So we have some time frame here to make this happen. But just so that you know, there are some things that are in our control and some things that are not in our control. And that's one of those things that's not. And I don't anticipate a problem with it, but I think it's worth being aware of.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Yeah. The multi-agency review timelines are not often quick. So that's we've come up to that issue before. But I have to say Anita is very good at needling them to get their reviews back to us, much better than pretty much any Village Safe Water project manager I've ever worked with. So, so thank you, Anita.
Well, you're welcome. And you're right. I work very hard to push these things. I guess when you've been in the doing the work for over 30 years, you kind of don't care about stepping on a few toes. If something is on the line here. And I want to thank you both, Anson and KC, hit on the points that I was planning to bring up, is that community engagement and involvement really is key to the success, because we don't want to put forth a recommendation that the community that surprises the community or worse is something that the community does not want. And I love working with communities that are involved, because I think the success rate on those are very high. And Casey is very, very brought up the timeline, which is great, because she's correct. Right around March is when we need to get at least 95% document ready. That's about when the last day that the multi-agency review committee will accept documents for consideration for funding in the next funding cycle. So that is the key date. We don't have a firm one yet because it changes every year, but it happens in March. And we have plenty of time at this stage, we're sitting very well for making this deadline. I've worked with Casey and Anson on another project that started later than this, and we made it. It was hard, but we made it. So Gustavus is in a good position. timeline wise anyway. Thank you.
I guess one other question I'd ask, if you feel you can do the answer at this stage, what are the typical kinds of solutions that are applied for communities like ours across Alaska? What, I mean, there's probably a range.
We can open so much of a box if we wanted to. But I guess the range of alternatives, what we try to do is get a broad base of very well, including no action, do what you're doing now, but everything from a sort of very simple treatment process, and we can just talk about treatment for now, but a very simple low energy, low manpower process, and then we can go all the way through to complex plants with lots of pumps, and there's kind of everything in between, and the same. I don't really want to get in specifics of actual technologies, and because I don't want to I want to make sure that we have enough research and planning done before we present these officially. So, okay. But generally the general process will be some sort of dewatering, whether that is mechanical or gravity or other pumps and all that stuff. And then we have to dispose of and we've got the solids and the liquids of, and how we're going to dispose of those. And there's quite a few. There are some communities that have done septage lagoons, which is just a lagoon that you pump your septage into and it just sits there. I don't really anticipate that being the best solution here, based on what I've seen, but that is a solution that some communities have used. So, hopefully that was vague enough to answer your question, but not put me, pigeonhole me us later when we write the report.
We'll look forward to seeing your options.
Well, I do have a question. Is there something specific? Just wondering if behind that question is there something specific that the community wants us to look at?
Well, this is Shelley. I guess maybe PFAS. I don't know if the septic sewage lagoons test for PFAS, but that would be something of concern in the community.
Yep. So we did some research. I noticed in our scope of work that PFAS was listed and that's something that the community is worried about. So I did some digging onto current EPA regulations for that. And right now PFAS is basically in everybody's wastewater. So it is a pretty common product that is being used daily by a lot of people. And I recognize that there are sources that can create a point source, so it can be a concern for drinking water. And we are just now starting to roll out drinking water regulations and making sure that the water we're consuming does not have PFAS in it. And the only way to do that on a large scale right now is like membrane technology, which is really expensive and a lot of energy, takes a lot to run that. There's currently not a good way to remove it from wastewater at any sort of scale, and other than burning, and that is not economical, and it sounds like not something that the community is particularly interested in doing. I think in a better case scenario would be finding a way to isolate and or locate our waste that we're going to generate here somewhere away from any drinking water sources and from I know there's a desire to do spreading and like keeping off of land that you're going to then grow food on, but like trying to minimize our footprint of where it's going. But I think it's unrealistic to, at this point in time, given the best available technology, to remove it from our waste streams. And that's kind of what they're seeing across the U.S., unfortunately.
From a regulatory perspective, in the wastewater, PFAS is not yet regulated. It's considered an emerging contaminant, and more data is being gathered. So that may change in the future, but there is no way for us to predict that at this time. So other than, you know, as Casey mentioned, trying to keep that footprint small, we're basically approaching it as if there will be no change in the future. And if something comes up while we're in the middle of this, we can always pivot, but we're moving forward as if it will continue not to be regulated. But like I said, we can pivot when that time comes, because until it is actually regulated, we don't know how to address it. You know, we don't know what that goal is. I hope that answers your question. Or
yes, thank you.
Yeah, go ahead.
The groundwater is being held now, being aerated or not? Is it anaerobic, or do you have an aerator, or you just hold the stuff in tanks? I don't know.
We're just holding it in tanks for now. It was a temporary problem. There were a temporary.
It'll deteriorate much faster. It'll turn into nitro humus about 3 times as fast. You can get rid of it a lot quicker if you can do that. I used to install this stuff and study it quite a bit. And so all you have to do is put a pump in there and start spraying it. Spraying it and circulating it where the air can get to it, and you get a faster bacteria that'll eat this stuff up. It'll turn, and pretty soon it'll stop staking, and you'll get the nitro humus out of it, and you can use it for other things. It's real simple, that would just my suggestion. So
yeah, we will actually be looking at an aerobic digester, which is basically what was described. Yeah, that is likely going to be one of the alternatives that we will discuss.
Okay, I just wanted to add that, you know, once upon a time, the compost consideration was probably in the forefront. But then when PFAS came into the mix, it's just not so much there anymore. I mean, Even Juno, bakes their sludge into what they call these little biscuits, and they're not even allowed to incinerate those after they've dewatered them and to the point of just being a hard substance. So we're limited here in what we can do, and we may be reduced to, you know, just shipping out solids. You know, once we get to that point, which is probably 80% less volume than what we're doing now. So, will we ever have an ideal situation? Probably not. If we ever get to the point where the PFAS contamination is negligible, we may be able to get there. But people are going to have to recognize that is a huge, you know, a huge part of what we're not going to be able to do when we come up with a solution. So just putting that out there, that it's not as simple as it may once have been. Thanks.
Yeah, at least for me, the idea of composting and then spreading waste that has PFAS in it onto crops is probably not going to be an alternative that we'll really do a lot of digging into, but yeah, we do recognize that it's, you know, that would be the ideal if it were the case. So
I have a question, I guess, for the community. Have you guys tested your existing waste at all for PFAS levels? Okay.
No. And when I was talking to Anson on the phone, I thought, you know, maybe once we get into this, even if we have a different solution, we could have like a test batch of compost, just sludge compost, because we started to do that out at the park once upon a time, but it got shut down after the people who started it left and nobody else wanted to do it. So But that was before PFAS. But, you know, they would have been a prime example because they have treated water out there, right? So they don't have, you know, that contamination. But my thought was once we get something going, maybe having a test pile and then testing it once it was composted and see what the levels were to just know, you know, and if it turned out too high, then okay, we can't do it. If it didn't, then maybe we could look at a different alternative down the road. So
I think the other thing that's worth keeping in mind around this subject is our sources. My guess is that the majority of PFAS that would end up in your waste is not coming from this point source that you're drawing from, but rather people's habits. It's in quite a few beauty products and rain gear and nonstick pans. So any sort of wastewater that is going down the drain could be sourced and not necessarily what's coming out of the tap from your drinking water. So if we do go down the road or you guys choose to do testing, I think that there's several locations that would be beneficial for understanding the complete picture of what's happening, including from the source and then probably from the tap and then waste and then your compost. So we can kind of see what's happening there. And my guess is that you also probably have an influx of it when you have tourist season happen and it go back down when during the winter time. So there's a lot of it around, and I know it's difficult to even test. Like you have to have special gear and stuff to, cause it's everywhere.
Well, there's plumes here. Okay. And there's test wells here, although they haven't funded them past last year. They're not funded to be testing them anymore. Mm-hmm. The people who had the higher levels who have cistern systems. I mean, I don't know if groundwater is sinking into their septic or if they're just displacing water from their cistern systems. So, yeah. You know, that's a whole nother question.
Yeah.
Going back to the question of, knowing whether it's too much or not enough in the resulting dried sludge, is right now, it's not a regulated substance in wastewater. So the question of, hey, do you have too much or would it be okay to do X, Y, and Z with this product that we get at the end? We don't know that answer yet because there is no regulation regarding that. And we're, they're gathering, the toxicologists are gathering more information to feed into the federal regulators and those that look at risks. And with time, they'll probably come up with some number and start regulating it. But at this point, I just want to point out that testing it now, it would be, it'll give you some information, but the question is, what would you do with it? And right now, there's not a lot we can do with it. Once the regulations, if there were to be regulations in the future about it, then we would have something, some sense of what you can do with that information that you collect. So does that make sense? I'm all for testing and finding out if at some point what you have, but until we have some sense of what's too much or what's considered safe, we don't have that right now in the wastewater. So
you don't have it in wastewater, but do you have it in the dewatered byproducts? Because the way I understand it is Juno is not allowed to burn their dried product because of what's in the PFAS that's in it. So if there's no regulatory standard for PFAS in wastewater, why the inability of them to burn the dried product?
My understanding of Juno's situation, and I was kind of hoping Bob would be online to set us straight, was they had a few years back, they had an issue with their incinerator and it broke. So then they started shipping it out. And those incinerators are I've got, well, I don't know, personal experience with the Anchorage has an incinerator as well. But I have friends who work at the water and wastewater utility, and those incinerators are extremely expensive to run, and they break down all the time. Extremely maintenance heavy. And I think the Juno issue is not so much a regulatory issue as a cost issue. So if they were able to dry all their sludge, they don't have that much. I mean, they have a lot of bulk, but they have much less bulk than they've been shipping, and they don't need to bring it all the way up to incinerator temperatures to get the ash. So I believe that it's more of a incinerator issue rather than a PFAS issue. And I also could be wrong.
Yeah, that was kind of what I had heard also from different meetings, although I couldn't tell you exactly when and from whom. But the other piece there is incinerating is one of the few ways we have to currently break down the PFAS chemical. So if they were unable to burn it there, my assumption would be that it's either not hot enough or they can't isolate it or get it dry enough to get it hot enough to break down that compound, because it's close to like 600 degrees Celsius required for some of the PFAS chemicals, because it's a whole group of chemicals, to be broken down.
Is there any risk that we could build a system here that with changing regulations would be suddenly obsolete and unusable for that reason?
I think our goal and our preferred alternative will be one that if there is a, and I would, in the crystal ball that I have of wastewater regulations would likely be the solids. And so I think our goal would be to have a solution that if there is future PFAS regulations in septic solids, that there's not a whole lot of change that has to happen.
Yeah,
or if there does have to be a change, it's a fairly straightforward one. It's not a, you guys now have to install an incinerator and try to run an incinerator. Like that's, yeah, I think that's the goal, is to have a solution that will be able to change with the regulations fairly easily. Like, yeah.
Good.
The other thing I want to bring up is, well, with the current drinking water regulations that just came out in July, I believe, the current administration is working very hard to provide funding as well to help communities get up to spec, so to say. So that your funding sources are aware that you can't just pivot on a dime and expect you to meet these regulations the next day. There's going to be some grace period there, and they're also going to try to help you get there. So I don't anticipate any solution that we come up with there being regulations that roll out and suddenly you guys are obsolete and starting this process over again. If anything, we're just building onto it.
And you're aware, I believe, that everybody's on individual wells here. We don't have a municipal system to which those regulations apply.
Yeah.
Yeah. But a similar vein of, if there were wastewater regulations and you have you still have decentralized wastewater treatment, but you have this centralized system. If they're going to start saying you need to do this, hope won't leave you high and dry. Again, nothing is for certain.
Well, if past behavior is indicative of future behavior, typically, as Casey said, they provide a grace period. And a lot of times it's based on your population, the larger ones being regulated sooner and the smaller ones generally being regulated a little later in time, simply because a lot of times for the smaller communities, the resources aren't as available. But in the past, that is how the regulations have been implemented.
Is there any Anybody else who wants to ask any questions or make any comments? Come on, Ponch, you got to have something to say.
And I guess if either any of the people in this room or in this meeting or people listening to this in the future would like to get a hold of us, Kathy has our contact information. We can filter the questions to us and when there are any.
Yeah, me or our city clerk, Liesl, can also pass them along. Okay. Are we done? I think we're done.
I think I covered all I wanted to cover. So thank you all.
Thank you.
That's helpful. Yeah. Thanks.
Yeah. Thanks, Anita. We stole the sunshine from you in Anchorage.
Yes, it is raining. It's very miserable. But I'm happy for all of you and Gustavus. You all have a special place in my heart. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Bye, Anita. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. Bye.
Good night, everybody.